Working the night shift can be difficult and it can be hard on your health, but it's also critical for our economy and for keeping our communities safe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this week on Talk of Iowa, it's Iowa Week, and we're exploring Iowa after dark. This hour, I'll talk with three people who work overnights. We'll meet an emergency veterinarian. She works overnights on weekends. We'll also talk with an emergency room nurse who works the overnights at University of Iowa hospitals and clinics in the emergency room. And finally, I'll go on a ride along with a police officer. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week. All this week on Talk of Iowa, we're exploring Iowa after dark. Tomorrow, we'll end the week with nightlife, but today, it's all about work. We've learned that working the night shift can take a serious toll on people. In fact, there's even a term for it, shift work disorder. At the same time, overnight jobs are often important, even critical for keeping our communities safe, and there's no doubt that they play an important part in the economy. Working overnights can be a way to get your foot in the door career-wise. Pay is sometimes better for working those difficult hours, and a lot of parents turn to shift work to avoid paying for daycare. This hour, I'll talk with three people who work overnights, a nurse who works the overnight shift in the emergency room at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, and I'll ride along with Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department. My first guest today is an emergency veterinarian. Dr. Janelle Caro works at the Eastern Iowa Veterinary Specialty Center in Cedar Rapids. She works 12 or 14-hour overnight shifts, 11 shifts a month. Dr. Caro, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And what drew you to emergency vet work?
I fell into it initially because when I was had graduated from vet school and was looking for a job, there was one that was available. I thought, well, you know, I'll try it. And I got hired, and it turned out that I just really, really loved it. I love the variety. There's something new every night. It's just kind of more, I guess, less routine than working a routine job. And so I also like the schedule a lot. And while it's not for everybody, I do have a lot of time off to spend with my family and to do things that I want to do. And so I just prefer it now to a 9-to-5 type job.
All right. Well, let's talk about the kinds of things you do, because I'm sure it's less routine, but it probably is sometimes a little overly exciting. What's a night? Maybe there isn't a typical night, but what's a typical night like in your work?
Yeah, and so there are some patterns, I think. And so I come to work at 6 p.m., and we tend to be in the evenings busiest probably between about 5 and 10. And we may see between probably 6 to 10 emergencies come in at that time. And then we also have a hospital and an intensive care unit. And so probably on an average night, we might have 5 or 6 patients. I've had probably as many as 15 or 16 patients in the hospital, which is really a lot. The kind of severity of things varies from dogs with broken toenails to pets that are vomiting and having diarrhea to things like dogs that have been hit by a car and have a collapsed lung or internal bleeding. And so there's really a wide variety of severity of things, as well as kind of amount of things that we see.
Wow. So, and as a pet owner, I think a lot of us believe in Murphy's Law, that all the worst things are going to happen at night or on the weekends. So you probably deal with a lot of people who everything's been fine, but now suddenly my pet is in distress.
Yep, that's true.
When you bring somebody in, or when somebody brings an animal in that is in distress, what is your role? I mean, you triage the animal, but what are you trying to figure out as the overnight emergency care?
Well, we're kind of trying to find the source of the problem as quickly as we can. And we don't always obtain a diagnosis right away, but there's always something you can do to kind of alleviate the problem, whether it be intravenous fluids for a pet that's dehydrated or oxygen for a pet that's having trouble breathing. And the other important part about my job is trying to explain what's going on to the clients, because they you know, their animal can't tell them what's going on, and through a physical exam and observation and things like that, then I may be, you know, more able to kind of explain what's going on, you know, what do we do from here? Because it can be very frightening, of course, for the clients when their animal is sick.
Well, and they have to make life or death decisions sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
Emergency vet care is also really expensive.
It can be, yes.
So, and unfortunately, that's one of those conversations you have to have as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Need to talk about the money.
Yep, we do need to talk about the money. And that can be hard. I think that I've been working for 12 years, and I feel like people have gotten a better idea, I think, and are maybe less surprised about the costs of things, but also expect, you know, a very really a quality care and a high level of care similar to what they would expect from a human hospital. And so we're happy that we're able to provide that in many cases. But we do have to talk about the cost more than you would in a human hospital, because that's usually something that's kind of discussed later in those conditions, even though it's certainly not free and certainly is expensive as well.
Right, because that for a lot of people, that has to weigh in on the decision about whether we try to save a life or choose a different path.
And that's the, you know, we try to be very honest about things like prognosis. And there is a difference between an expensive treatment that's, say, to fix a broken leg in a one-year-old dog and an expensive treatment for a 15-year-old dog with cancer. And so it's, I try really hard to kind of help guide people through those decisions and to think about what's best for their pet, regardless of the money.
I can imagine that would take an emotional toll on you. Is that difficult?
And it can be. I think that it's somewhat about perspective. And so I think that there's a lot of emotional situations, and sometimes people's emotions turn to anger or frustration. And I think it's, you know, I try to keep in mind that that's, you know, what's going on and that it's not directed at me. And I think that I also see how much having that guidance and support helps people. And so that is kind of the flip side of it. It's difficult, but people are really grateful for the support and the help. And we have, you know, colleagues are supportive. And so that's a big help. You know, there's always somebody else around. And so there's a lot of support from other, you know, employees, other colleagues at the hospital.
Yeah, I can imagine not just the other veterinarians, but the people who work the front desk. I mean, this is an emotional time for a lot of the people that come in. Yeah. Everybody has to be involved.
Yep, everybody's involved.
So what are some of the things you say you really love the work? And I'm sure it's exciting. And I'm sure you have victories. What are some of the things that really make it feel worthwhile to you?
Yeah, so I always tell people my favorite emergency is stick in the mouth, which is essentially a dog has been chewing on a stick, or, you know, like there's varieties of it, but they come in and they're like smacking their lips and there's something is wrong and they don't know what it is. And you look in their mouth and there's a stick stuck between your teeth and you take it out and they're immediately better.
And
I love those types of things.
It must be a lot of
like the bones that get stuck around their bottom jaw and fish hooks. I like those a lot too. And so I do like the quick victories wherein you can immediately make them feel much better and they go home and everybody's happy. And so I do like those a lot.
Dogs make bad choices.
They do.
And how would you describe how your relationship with the people who bring in their pets to emergency vet care might be different than working in a regular vet practice?
And so usually in a regular vet practice, the people will know the vet, or they'll at least know the practice. They'll know the nursing staff. They'll know the front desk staff, even if they haven't seen that particular vet before. Most of my clients I've never seen before, though, unfortunately, I do see some certain clients sometimes we'll see frequently. And so we immediately have to establish some trust and establish a relationship. And that can be difficult with people who are, you know, at a high stress level. They may be up in the middle of the night and not have slept well, or, you know, and so that can be challenging. And so we work really hard on that with staff training and continuing education and things like that to kind of try and how can we do the best we can to make people comfortable with what we're doing so that we can help them make the best decisions for their pet.
These days, you probably see mostly dogs and cats, but given it's the middle of the night, your pet's in distress, do you get calls about a lot of other kinds of creatures too?
We do about some. And so at our hospital, we see only mammals. We don't see birds or reptiles, but we do see small mammals. probably my favorite small mammal, I would say, is the rat, which is not some people are surprised about, but I think that people should give rats a try if they have never met one before, because they have big personalities and they're really great little animals. But we also see rabbits and sometimes guinea pigs and gerbils and ferrets, things like that. I have in the past been a mixed animal veterinarian, and so I don't see livestock right now, but I used to also see cows and horses and occasionally pigs. And llamas and those sorts of creatures too. And
wow, so you've seen just about everything. What kind of an emergency does a rat have that brings them into the hospital?
And so they tend to get upper respiratory diseases, and so it's common for us to see rats with pneumonia or upper respiratory infections. They can also get middle ear infections, and they might like circle or have a head tilt. They don't live a long time, and they often die of cancer, and so we do see that sometimes too, rats with masses or tumors.
Now, you are a health professional. You work with animals, but humans are animals too. Do you think about the toll that working these kinds of hours might take on your health?
I do, and it's something that I worry about somewhat, because if you read the studies, there's some serious detrimental effects.
It's pretty scary,
yeah. But I just really hard to focus on other aspects of my health, make sure I get enough exercise and eat well and sleep as regularly as I can, and try to focus on those things, because I think that there's a trade-off between loving what you do and your health, and I don't feel that personally I have experienced a lot of detrimental effects of it so far.
And what makes it worthwhile? What are not just the work, but what else makes it worthwhile in your life? How do you make it work for you?
And so I think that the family time is really important to me. And so I have a 9-year-old son, and I've been doing this for my entire career, so since before he was born. And I found that it allowed me to have time with him in the afternoon, and so I can sleep while he's at school, and then we can do things together. And then also I have a lot of weekdays off, so I can do field trips and volunteer at school and a lot of things that I wouldn't be able to do if I had a normal job. And so that is one of the things that really makes it worthwhile, I think, all of the free time that comes from working kind of condensed long hours.
And when you save a life, is that a feeling you carry with you through the week?
It is, definitely.
Well, Dr. Janelle Caro, thank you so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Janelle Caro works the night shift at the Eastern Iowa Veterinary Specialty Center in Cedar Rapids. She works 12 or 14-hour overnight shifts, 11 shifts a month. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Corey, a registered nurse who works the overnight shift at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And then later in the hour, I'll go for a ride-along with Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This week is Iowa Week, and all week long we've been exploring Iowa After Dark. You can find the shows you may have missed on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about nightlife as we end the week, but today we're talking about work, working the night shift. In a few minutes, I'll ride along with Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department. But with me now is Corey. He's a registered nurse who works the overnight shift at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in the emergency room. He's asked us to only use his first name because of the nature of his work. He graduated from nursing school in 2016. Before that, he was a paramedic for 16 years, so he has plenty of experience with the night shift. Corey, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Well, first of all, I mean, you work in the emergency room, you work overnight shifts, and you mostly do weekend work?
I do, yep. I work what they would call the graveyard shift, so from 2300 hours till 0700 in the morning.
All right, yeah. And you work in Iowa City.
I do.
A big college town.
Yeah.
So what's a night like in the ER?
Well, there's a lot of variables that go into what kind of night. College football makes our night a little different. Sometimes we get a lot of people from the stadium, whether they've had too many spirits or have a medical emergency. And then, of course, we get all the rural areas that are looking to further the care of the patient for further evaluation, may send patients to us frequently.
So if somebody went to a small hospital outside of Iowa City, they may wind up in the emergency room in Iowa City?
Absolutely, because we're going to evaluate all patients, probably 95% of the patients that come to the hospital from an outside hospital. We're going to bring them through the emergency room and evaluate them first to make sure they're quote-unquote stable. And then they evaluate the patient and decide what floor of the hospital the patient should go to for continuing care.
And in the emergency room, especially overnight, you have people coming in who have no other place to go.
We do. We do have a population here in Iowa City, as most cities do, of people that can't get into the shelter that night, or choose not to go to shelters, or have utilized all the resources in the community to a fault sometimes, and maybe they're not welcome any longer. And so they use us as a resource. And
so from emergencies, from minor emergencies, major emergencies, to really being a refuge of last resort.
That is correct, yeah.
Do you deal with a lot of mental health issues at night?
We do. As you know, as most people know anyway, the mental health crisis in Iowa is staggering along, nationwide. It's a problem. And that's one of the reasons I chose to only use my first name, mm-hmm. is sometimes we come in contact with people who are physically aggressive, and we rely on what is called CPI training, that we're taught, we're tested, we're certified in that, and it's a non-violent form of subduing a patient or a person who may be a harm to themselves or others. And so a lot of times, there are times when we're threatened, and keeping anonymity is important to me and most nurses, because, we also live in the community. So we may see these people in Target or at Hy-Vee or at Walmart. And so it becomes very important to us to, keep our scene safe, our family scene safe, and that, so.
What drew you to this type of work?
I'm sorry?
What drew you to this type
of work?
Well,
it's a funny story. I was actually a golf professional working at a semi-private golf club. I was the director of golf. I had worked there for several years. I got bored over the winter because you can't play golf in the snow. And I took an EMT class, and I got hooked. And then I went a little further and got some more certifications. And then I started working for a private ambulance company in the Omaha, Nebraska area through the winter. And then I found myself in the spring and summer at the golf course, surrounded by beauty, and I'm like, wow, this just isn't as exciting as the ambulance was. And so from there, I just decided to take the leap into nursing. And
why? Why nursing?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question. As a former medic, money played a pretty large role, to be honest with you. Unfortunately, the EMS services don't pay their people great, and they should. I'm always an advocate for higher wages. And then, two, the patient contact. In the EMS world, you're with a patient maybe 7 minutes, hopefully always less. But nursing allows you to learn about the patient, make a bond with the patient, try to provide their care, and then maybe follow them down the road to see how their care wound up.
We talked about the wide array of things you might encounter in the emergency room on a given night.
Sure.
Give me an idea of what your role is. How do you interact with patients, and how do you get assigned to different circumstances?
Well, a lot is based on staffing. So when I walk in the room and my shift starts, I usually take what is called a nursing report from another nurse who is leaving, and they bring me up to speed on each patient that they're monitoring. And tell me all about them, the medications, anything that you need to know to further their care. And I take those patients over. And then the charge nurse, who kind of is the captain of the ship every night, will then assign you patients based on their acuity, how many patients you have, what your skill set is. So
how many patients might you interact with in a given night?
Oh, we usually run everyone, you know, 3 to 6 patients apiece. We might see 12 to 15 patients in a shift, depending on what circumstances they're coming in with. We're a level one trauma center, so we get traumas flown to us from all over the state of Iowa. And when those people arrive, everything stops and they get your full attention because they're the most critically injured or ill patient. And so that's an addition to the load you're already carrying. So you rely a lot on your coworkers to look after your other patients so you can tend to these patients that are coming in that need you the most.
How many nurses are you usually working with?
Oh, you could work anywhere between 8 to 12, sometimes 5.
So you've got, I mean, in an ideal situation, you have a pretty big team.
In the perfect situation, we have a good team, a large team. Unfortunately, due to staffing and people's lives, sometimes we run a little short.
Right. I mean, there is a nursing shortage in this country.
There sure is. Yeah.
So when you say you were drawn to this work because of the excitement, give me an example of what you experienced that made you think this is something I want to be a part of.
Going to a crime scene where there's multiple gunshot wound victims. It's a touch of chaos, and yet law enforcement's deemed that scene safe. You come in, you try to mobilize and stabilize the patients as quickly as you can and leave the area. And then watching the hospital staff respond to you when you arrive and watching the controlled chaos that ensues within that hospital wall to revive a patient, stop a major bleed, several people in the room all doing different things but doing it all harmoniously. It's my drug.
Yeah, it's an adrenaline rush.
It is. It definitely is.
And you must feel like you're making a real difference.
You do. You do. There's so many successful occurrences. There's also events that don't go the way you wish and people expire, and those are difficult times, but the other times bring you through those troubled times, those hard times. The success stories, they keep you going. The teamwork and how you got through that situation as a team keep you going.
I'm talking with Corey. He is a registered nurse who works the overnight shift at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics emergency room. He also spent a number of years working as a paramedic, so he's been in emergency medical care for a long time. And Corey, talking about that adrenaline, is that part of why you've chosen to work the overnights in the emergency room?
It's why I chose emergency medicine, without a doubt. I knew going into nursing school that that was the only place I wanted to be. I knew that was my niche, if you will, and I knew there was a great need for it. And so that was by my choosing. And when I started looking for employment after nursing school, they were the only units I was interested in applying to.
And is overnight care the only way to get your foot in that door?
Well, a lot of new nurses start out on the overnight shift, unfortunately, just due to seniority. But I chose it on purpose. One, there's a lot of action overnight during those hours. And two, it was a schedule that was most conducive to me to being able to provide my family with quality time from me.
How does that work? How do you find your balance?
It's tough. We were talking a little bit ago how Monday and Thursday are my transition days.
Because you work over the weekend.
Right. I work over the weekend. And so when I get home at 0800 on Monday morning and turn the nurse switch off and turn the dad switch on, then I try to stay up as late Monday as possible, 5, 6 p.m. And then I'll crash and try to get on a schedule then for Tuesday morning to be up and awake and alert when my family is. So, and then Thursday, then I transition then back into nights where Thursday I'll try to stay up just as late as I possibly can, hopefully till the sun comes up. I'll get a couple hours, take my son to school, come back home and get to bed.
Wow.
So.
And are you good at making that transition? Does your body respond?
I don't know if anybody's good at it. You know, we do a lot of things like we have peripheral blue lights at work that is supposed to help reset your circadian rhythm, which a lot of research shows is the reason people who work third shift have health problems is their circadian rhythm can't find its rhythm. It's always on or off, and it's not conducive to
life.
The stability
right.
of your body, I
right.
guess.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's hard, but it's something that can be done. You have to plan. It's like these people who go on these great diets and they meal prep all the time. I sleep prep. That's what I do.
And how do you make sure you can sleep when you get the opportunity?
Well, that's difficult too, being a husband and a dad. But I have a great support system at home, and they allow me the flexibility to go into a dark room and get some sleep.
And you're pretty good at falling asleep when you do that?
Not always. Sometimes I have to eat a lot of food to get tired, like the Thanksgiving nap. Other times I will mow the lawn or try to do some sort of physical activity to try to wind down a little bit.
Have you noticed a toll on your health from working these hours?
Not really. I would say not really. Just that I'm tired all the time. Even after I can wake up, I'm tired. You know, everyone asks me, are you feeling okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm just tired. I'm just tired.
With the team you work with on the weekends, I mean, mm-hmm. you've talked about how the adrenaline and the opportunity to really make a difference and help someone, maybe even save a life, is part of what keeps you going.
Mm-hmm.
But I can imagine that that takes a toll as well. Do you have a way to support each other when you're going through these ups and downs and, and the wins and the losses?
When we have tragic events, we UIHC offers us crisis debriefing where we'll all get together and talk about what happened in the room, what could have went better, what we did great, what we can improve on. And then ultimately then sometimes we even get a summary on down the road from the medical examiner that alleviates you of some stress because they say, you know, regardless of the interventions you guys tried to pull off, we don't believe that anything would have been successful with this patient. So it's nice to be able to close the book and move on. None of those people you ever forget.
Right.
You know?
Do you have coworkers who have had to stop working this kind of work because of that toll?
You know, I would hate to speak for someone else because I don't really know. Mm-hmm. I know the turnover rate nationwide in emergency or trauma nursing is large. People don't stay there long because the stress can get to you and you see things that sometimes you're not prepared to. I went through all that years ago, making sure that this is what I wanted to do, you know, and there were plenty of times of speculation where it was like, wow, maybe I had to, you know, do something else, but then you have those occurrences that are positive that really keep you going back.
Have you developed a system for compartmentalizing and allowing yourself to leave?
My wife's a counselor. So I can go right home and sit down and just go blah, and we'll ride that wave together and we'll get through it and talk about it and try to. I talk a lot, so I'm like ultimate communicator. Like I'll tell you exactly how I'm feeling. So we have a good relationship in that she can provide some comfort or counseling, if you will, free counseling at home over breakfast. Yeah.
You've been working this shift for a couple of years now, right?
I have, a little over 2 years, yeah.
How long do you think you'll be working the night shift?
I don't know. As long as it is conducive to the family schedule, you know, that's really what it comes down to for me. When it doesn't work for us as a family unit, then I'll do something else.
On the hard days, is there something you return to in your brain? Is there a sort of a mantra that you think about that keeps you going?
I remember how hard I worked through nursing school and how there were times I was like, I don't know if I can do this. And so when those situations come up that make you guess, I just always rely back to how hard I worked to get here.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Corey is a registered nurse who works the overnight shift at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. This hour, we're talking with people who work the third shift. It's Iowa Week, and all week long, we've been exploring Iowa after dark. As we talk about working the night shift in just a few minutes, we'll listen as I go on a ride along with Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department. If you've missed any of our Iowa Week shows this week, you can find them on our website at iowapublicradio.org. You can even see some pretty great pictures as well. You can check out our Twitter feed for that also at IPR. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with people who work overnights. And last week, one very late night, I went out with Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department. He became a police officer about 5 years ago, and he's been working the night shift in Iowa City ever since. I showed up as he was starting his night's work.
All right. We ready?
Yes.
All right.
So what do you think is the most challenging thing about working nights?
It's definitely the sleep. I've found a way to make my sleeping as best as it can be, and it's still a very unhealthy lifestyle. I'm not the kind of person to be against caffeine. I drink it a lot, but I also am aware that it's that it's not great for me, and the being up at night, you get used to it, but your body never acknowledges that it's natural. It's not natural to be up all night and to be going to bed at 8 a.m.
Something that we've talked about on the program several times in the last couple of years is need for mental health care in Iowa and how the police end up really playing an active role in mental health care. How does that play into your life on the night shift?
Big time. The hours can make it tough to find resources. Not every resource is 24/7. There are a lot of resources that are 24/7, but certainly not all of them. As far as the night shift focus would go, I would say one of the things I love about it is because we're not always as busy as other shifts, you can really spend the time that it takes to get the outcome you're looking for. When you do get called to be a part of someone's life in that crisis.
Can you give me an example? I don't want you to violate anybody's confidentiality, but can you give me an example of a time you've had to put that crisis intervention training into action?
I mean, I'd honestly say nightly. Everyone's different, but everyone really needs to be understood. And the communication, communication is huge. And I've watched officers who let people's, you know, who are way up here and just hyped and screaming and upset about something that to a person behaving rationally and not in a crisis would have no reason to be behaving that way about or to be upset about, just to hear them out and to have the ability to communicate patiently and I guess
de-escalate in a situation. Like that.
Absolutely, but a specific situation, one that I, a person that I met not too long ago, had been telling his live-in ex-girlfriend. They moved in together because they were dating. They broke up because of financial situation. Couldn't separate. He was suffering from depression and was suicidal at times. Well, he had made comments about killing himself that night. And so she called us because she was concerned. And when we got there, he downplayed it greatly. Had no interest in going anywhere. Said, I'm fine, you know. He didn't want to go to the hospital. I felt on multiple levels he would. I mean, sincerely, I felt he should go to the hospital because of his statements, because of his thoughts of suicide. But also, unfortunately, liability reasons exist as well. And I talked to him, I don't know, upwards of an hour, tried all sorts of different angles. And he kept saying he couldn't go because he was hungry and he didn't want to be stuck in the ER all night, and because he just didn't feel like he should have to go. And I finally went through the angle of explaining everything I was hearing back to him, and then kind of put it on him of the situation he was putting me in. That's not something I normally do, but it seemed like it was going to work with him. I said, just imagine how Mike, me, you know, and I like to personalize it, I'm not an officer or anybody, I'm Mike, is going to feel leaving here tonight, wondering the rest of my shift and maybe even tomorrow, like, what's going to happen to you if I just leave you here in this situation? And I could tell that I finally reached him somehow. And again, that's a rare one. I wouldn't normally do that, but that's the way I reached him. And he finally agreed to go with me. I mean, it was a longer conversation than that, but he finally agreed to go with me. And as a reward, we went and sat at McDonald's and ate dinner together because he said he was hungry. And it's pretty incredible to be involved in someone's life like that for just that moment. I mean, other than you asking about it, I don't know if I would even remember that. And I'll probably forget it after tonight. For a long time, but
it sounds like you really felt like you helped him.
I felt like I did. I hope I did. It's really unfortunate that you can't do as much as you want to do sometimes. But it felt like I did. I felt like if nothing else, I helped him on that night. Whether I turned his life around or not, I probably couldn't fly that flag. But certainly felt like I. Was a major played a major role in surviving that night. I know every as growing up as a kid in Waterloo, every little interaction with law enforcement I ever had, I remember to this day, and that's a big responsibility to carry to know that a dozen times a night you're going to interact with somebody, and you're going to. Other than the major ones, you're gonna forget about it by tomorrow, but they're gonna remember it. They're gonna tell their friends. They're gonna talk about it on social media. Whatever they're gonna do with it, they're not gonna keep it to themselves, good or bad.
Obviously, there are people in our communities who are more nervous about interaction with law enforcement than others, and of course. There has been a lot of racial tension with law enforcement, a lot of reports of police violence specifically targeting black people or, other people of color. Mm-hmm. So in your interactions with the public, how do you think about that?
You feel it. You certainly feel it. Sometimes you'll get... individuals who are flying that flag out of a defense mechanism, and there's people who legitimately have a reason to believe that and feel that.
I agree.
It doesn't really come into my mind until it's pointed out by someone else. If I'm investigating a crime and talking to someone and they make the allegation of, if I was white, you wouldn't be doing that, and then I try to as politely as possible kind of shut that down. Say, nope, these are the facts that I was provided with, and you're here, and XYZ is what led me to believe that you're a person I should be talking to about what I'm investigating. If it is a black gentleman or woman, well, the description that was provided to me by the witness said it was a black male in a gray shirt, or whatever the case may be, and I say, it is unfortunate that if you are an innocent person involved in something like that, I mean, that does suck to have the cops stop you and talk to you about why you're here, what you're doing. I mean, and another thing I like to point out to people, and this is truth, this is sincere, is I'd rather have you frustrated with me over investigating a crime that I'm investigating and wasting a few minutes of your time than I'd rather live with that than live with, well, I don't want to piss this guy off. It might be the dude we're looking for, but I certainly wouldn't want him mad at me if he's not. And then ignoring it and then finding out I let someone's attacker get away because I didn't want the negative interaction, you know. I would much rather live with someone being frustrated with me than not doing my job, I guess.
So, mostly, you're on the quieter side of town.
513.
Have you had a situation since working in law enforcement where you felt like your life was in danger?
Yes. And it's interesting, those things, you do the things that your training kind of is telling you to do, or your instincts are telling you to do, and you're aware of the dangers, and you assess them appropriately. You're not being careless, but you don't really feel it until it's all over, and that can sometimes be quite the rush of, I guess, adrenaline, or a dump of adrenaline. There's been shootings that I've been a part of. When I say shootings, not police shooting someone, but others, suspects shooting, and then we catch those people or we encounter them while they're fleeing, and we know they have a gun, and we know they've recently used it in a violent manner. And those situations can certainly be very overwhelming, but it's just, although it can be scary, this mechanism of training kind of takes over, and you don't really your brain doesn't really download all the dangers. I mean, it does. You knew you were in danger and you were behaving accordingly, I would hope, you know, taking precautions and keeping yourself safe. But you're not overwhelmed with it in the moment. It kind of dumps on you later.
Sure, I'm sure that takes a lot of processing after the fact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of our CIT training that we've brought back to Iowa City, and the portion of it that I've been most passionate about is officer self-care and officer wellness, because that's certainly almost a taboo topic. You know, you got into this job, so why would you possibly need any help? Why would you need to have someone help you process things like that, or process fear, or process the sleep disorders that we develop and things like that? And I'm very proud of our department and law enforcement in general, getting a lot better at that, taking care of their officers and making sure that we're getting checked on, and not just spending 20 or 30 years burying stuff, you know, that you see. Because even in I think that the sad stuff you see, it eats at you a lot more than the scary stuff. The suicides and the accidents that might claim a life, especially if it's a child. Things like that. You could see so much of that. And
is there one of those incidents that comes back to you a lot that you find yourself thinking about?
My very first call for service was a suicide. And when I say very first, I mean I had been employed by the city of Iowa City for about 3.5 hours. And we did some paperwork for the morning. And then over the lunch hour, they had us go ride with officers. The very first day. And we went on a welfare check of a person who got fired from their job, and no one had heard from him for like 8 days or something. And we found him in his garage, deceased. And it was a very violent suicide. So just the combination of the sadness of it, plus having, I mean, just really no real idea of what happens to a human body when this one was a shotgun suicide. So I would say any call like that I'll always remember, but that one was unique because it was quite literally my very first call for service. That was kind of an overwhelming introduction to law enforcement. Hold on 1 second.
Sure.
So this is one of those moments where we probably won't continue to drive there the whole way. But we're going to start driving emergent now just in case.
All right. The lights are on.
So an officer that's on the domestic advised that the additional units who are coming, step it up. I mean, like, hurry up and get here. There's another officer who is just showing up already. So they have two there right now. And we,
2400 blocks of 2nd Street.
We're not very close, but no one else was answering, so we're going to say that. I let them know that we're going to go. And this is going to be kind of a long drive for us, but unless someone's closer, it's going to be on us to try to get there and help.
Okay.
So for something like this, because I don't really know what's going on, you can get out if you'd like, but I'm going to have you wait outside until you hear differently from me.
There's two other police vehicles at the scene as well. The officers have just brought a suspect out of the apartment building. They're putting him in the back seat of one of the vehicles.
So this is a domestic dispute. Is it somewhat similar to the instance that I was telling you about last night? In this instance, the female has some very obvious injuries. She will not tell us how it happened and doesn't want to talk to us about it. So she probably understands that could get him in trouble is probably why she doesn't want to talk about it, but he's being a little more open about it. He's kind of telling us what happened and how he feels it happened. And because they got in a physical altercation where someone got injured, it'd be really hard to explain why we didn't arrest someone. And then you have to kind of determine who was the primary aggressor is how you make that decision, and that person should be arrested according to the state law.
Do you feel like spending all this time in the community that you live in, spending all this time out at night, seeing what you see, doing what you do, do you feel like you know a different side of Iowa City?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm not from Iowa City, like I mentioned before, but even in Waterloo, when I said I didn't know what cops did all night, you know, I guess I always assumed, because I was naive enough to assume it, that what the cops did is what I saw in the news in the morning, you know? And if I didn't say anything on the news for a few days, that means they didn't do anything in the last few days, you know? I didn't realize these things aren't going to make the news. And some things even worse than this don't make the news. And it's intriguing, to say the least. It really changes your outlook on it. In fact, I think there was a time when I wasn't able to allow myself to enjoy just the vast majority of things that Iowa City has to offer, events and culture and everything like that, because I was letting the negativity I experienced kind of change what I thought Iowa City was. And it's not by any means a bad place. It's an amazing place, actually. But I think when I first came here, you know, I wouldn't say I had a dislike for it. It was just more of like a nervous thing of like, I don't want to be downtown when I have to go there for work. But now I can certainly see it in two different lights. Like, it's almost like it's not the same place.
Officer Mike Harkrider of the Iowa City Police Department, thank you so much to the Iowa City Police Department for allowing me to ride along with Officer Harkrider. This is Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa. We're going to finish up tomorrow with nightlife as we explore Iowa after dark. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. You can find us on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org and hear any shows you might have missed this week at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbie.